You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Danny Mefford. Danny is a fantastic choreographer. He and I went to the University of Evansville together as actors. And I'm so glad that we both live in New York City and are able to cross paths all these years later. He's always been such an intelligent, thoughtful artist, and I loved hearing about his process and journey. I hope you enjoy the 75th episode of The Compass. Well, how do you try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist? And what is the dark side for you most often?
Wow, Leah.
That's usually where I dive right in.
Okay. I think the dark side for me, if I were going to define for when I see the dark side in the distance and I have to remind myself not to go there, I think it has a lot to do with ego for me, and that I start feeling a pull to make dark decisions, like artistic decisions or even collaborative decisions, based on what I think is gonna be the best for me in the end.
Like in a career sense.
In a career sense. Yeah, and like in a selfish sense as well. I mean that like in a variety of ways too. Like when you're in rehearsal and you see two paths before you and one of them stops the conflict and one of them just like gets you what you want, if you just manipulate it a little bit, right? And is easier in some way. And the other one is like perhaps more collaborative, more like really letting the ideas that are in conflict with one another be in conflict with one another, but in a calm way, so that you can see what's at the truth in between that, if that makes any sense. And so that in a rehearsal way feels like the dark side to me, but in a more macro way, the dark side feels like just making decisions that are based on things that are going to get you praise or, you know, that kind of thing. And how I try to keep that dark side at bay is just by being open to other people, both in my life and in my work, you know, and just trying to be like, this is someone I'm here collaborating with. Theater is amazing, mostly because you can't make it alone. Like you have to make it with these other people. You need everyone to be able to do it. So, really being open and available to the fact that we're all working together.
And hopefully have the good of the piece in mind.
Yeah, exactly. With, you know, like really trying to tell a story that feels important to you, it really helps. But unfortunately, that's not always what you're doing. Like sometimes you do find yourself in a situation where you're like, I don't know if I stand behind this story.
Right.
Well, it's never, they're not all going to be these things that you feel so overwhelmingly lucky to be working on, actually. You know?
Yeah, sometimes it's just something to do.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes you really do have to just pay your rent. So take jobs, and trying to find a way inside of that to stay true to the work and to yourself, and like really try to still tell the story well with one another.
Yeah.
No.
How much are you usually involved once the show opens? Do you check in a lot again, or?
It depends.
On to the next one.
On the show. I pretty much move on to the next one. I mean, if something's running for a long time, of course you go back and see it. And when new people have to go into it, you see them in the show and, you know, try to help sculpt their performance a little bit. But, you know, there are other people whose job it is to kind of teach the new people, the show. Right. So
the stage management and the dance captains.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm just so delighted that you're a choreographer now. Since when you and I met, you're an actor.
I know.
I assume you're still an actor in some way. Do you still consider yourself an actor? Do you pursue that at all? Or?
I don't pursue it at all. I mean, do I identify as an actor? I don't identify as a performer anymore, mm-hmm. for sure. And performing I don't feel any draw to it right now. But I do think that what I do as a choreographer is mostly put myself inside these parts in the play and try to figure out what I would want to do and what would feel the most right to me. And then I offer that to...
So you're always doing that work.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's so... You know, for example, when I was doing Fun Home, I helped stage this solo that Medium Allison sings. And what I did to help stage that was I got in my room, I got on my bed, it's staged on a bed, and I just like sang the song, right? And did what felt right to me physically. And I definitely am not the right person to be playing Medium Allison, but the thing that's wonderful and delightful is that like you can enter into anybody's consciousness, right? Like you can try, especially if it's written well, and that show is written so well, like mm-hmm. you can really find yourself in it no matter who you are. And I love telling stories with bodies and movement. And so like I kind of shape it and then I offer that to the room. And it's never exactly what I would have done. It's not, you know, but there are ideas.
Yeah, you're still thinking about like who is that performer
and what are they bringing like physically, and like, you know, when I really sculpt it emotionally, like when I think of this is a moment of like giddiness, then I offer that it's a moment of giddiness and I like show a moment of giddiness in my body, but I don't demand that that person express giddiness in the same way I would physically.
Right. It's like, what's your version of that?
Yeah,
how does
exactly.
that come out of you when
exactly.
you think of that?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious, when people grow and change as artists, like when was the point when you did start identifying as a choreographer along the way?
Well,
more than a performer.
I was at the Williamstown Theater. Do you even know this story, actually? I'm curious.
I was internet stalking you just to see if there were things I didn't know. And I heard that that was when you started working on Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, exactly. So Aaron Felgar.
Who was in that and is one of your close friends.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Okay. She and I were both interns at the Williamstown Theater Festival. And Alex Timbers, who's a director, was also there. And he was a directing intern at the time. And she was in a play of his called The Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals. And anyway, that's what it was called. It's a great title. In it, the two characters did a spoof of a dance of how Martha Graham would choreograph Eve tempting Adam with the apple.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't have anyone to choreograph it. It was the Williamstown Theater Festival is a very like acting based place, not a musical theater based place or dance based place at all. And Aaron said to him, you know, my friend Danny is a great dancer. You should ask him to come in and choreograph it. And so he did. So I came in. It was like 30-second song. He thought it was really funny. I thought it was really funny. I had a really great time. Later that summer, he was doing a project and he had strangely written something that he wanted to do. And it was called Dance Dance Revolution. And it was a fusion of Japanese techno Disney pop with a futuristic story of an alien coming down from outer space to...
So not really related to that video game by the same title.
Kind of, in a weird way, because it was songs that were played on that video game, but Japanese Disney techno, right? Okay. And dance was illegal in this society, so this alien has to start a dance revolution to like overthrow the government. So he needed this choreographed, obviously. So he asked me to choreograph it. It was all booty all the time. like everyone was just shaking their booty like crazy. It was really great. Everyone at Williamstown loved it. It was very downtown and for the Williamstown community, a bunch of young artists. Uh-huh. The next summer, Alex and I were both back, but we had both like sort of climbed a rung of the ladder in the internship programs there. And now he was doing a workshop of a new musical that he was writing with Michael Friedman called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and he asked me to choreograph it, and I choreographed it. That show got kind of picked up and went to LA. And when it went to LA, they didn't ask me to choreograph it. And it's weird when I think back on it, because I didn't feel hurt at all related to your identifying question,
right?
Because I didn't identify as a choreographer. And I thought, oh, of course. Like,
it was just circumstantial.
It was, we I was together, there, yeah. And, you know, I identified as a performer and an actor. And it made total sense to me that they would hire someone who had a real choreography career to choreograph it. When they came back to New York, they asked me to choreograph it again because they had liked in the end what I had done at Williamstown more than what this other choreographer had done in LA. And they thought they just wanted my choreography back in the show, basically. And I was very shocked and delighted, of course. And then other people saw my choreography, started asking me to choreograph things. Weirdly, like, two of the people that I started choreographing for, Alex Timbers and Sam Gold, was one of the ones right after that, then went on to have these, like, and still are in the middle of having, like, amazing directing careers. And what that led to for me was this ability to watch all these different amazing directors do what they do and choreograph inside of that and, like, learn about my voice through that way. I really, for a long time, walked into every room thinking that eventually someone was going to say, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Why are you here? Please pack up your things and go. I very much felt like a fraud. And I can't really remember when that changed. It was a very, very gradual thing. Mm-hmm. That as I did more shows, I started feeling more like myself in those situations. It didn't feel as new. It didn't feel as strange. It felt like what I was engaged in. And then I stopped feeling that way, I think.
That's wonderful that you met these collaborators kind of when you were all on the same plane, the same part of your career. Was that the first time you had worked with Sam when you did Three Penny Opera at Juilliard?
That was the first time.
Oh.
And, you know, the only thing that we've done since then is Fun Home. So we really only done two projects together. But it's kind of amazing to think about what was going on in my life when we were doing Three Penny Opera, like how I felt about all that. And him, too. And then, like, being older and working together again. It's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. That's incredible. And when you, I actually was thinking, when you went to Brown for grad school and I came to visit that one time when I had been accepted, like I came
oh,
for like a
right.
visiting weekend
yeah.
where we took classes and stuff. And I remember you telling me about how the program really like requires you and lets you take directing classes, take playwriting, take acting. And I was like, this is perfect for you.
Yeah.
Because you've always
it was.
Been someone who was just, I felt like could invest yourself in a lot of different ways and you're so intelligent with looking at a room. Like I could see you as a director. I could see you as a playwright. Even when we were at Evansville and you took that year to go to Oxford, like.
Yeah. Cambridge.
Or
yeah.
Cambridge. I'm
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That was the perfect place for me. And interestingly, I met another artist there who is so integral to what I do now. His name is Stephen Bisher and he was a Commedia dell'arte performer. And I think he teaches movement at ACT now, but at
was
the
he acting there at the time or he was
no,
teaching?
he was a movement teacher.
Okay.
And so we did for the first semester at Brown, this black mask work where we all put on sheer black masks that you could see through, but where your identity was stripped from you and you had to wear all black. And we did just these movement exercises and we did it for like 3 hours straight, twice a week. When I think back on it, and then we slowly started adding character to these things through things like mask and,
but it's just
you know,
like having like a nylon over your head.
Yeah. It's like just like, yeah. Like you're going in to rob a bank or something. But it was really amazing. And he taught me so much about the specifics of how movement tells stories and how it expresses character and how you can tell narrative inside of that. And if I had never met him there, I really don't think I could do what I do right now. And I think back on that and like, I don't know what led me to Brown and to him, but It was a, yeah. You know, what a great gift.
I remember when I had first mentioned to you about wanting to have you on the podcast, like, over a year ago at the Evansville mm-hmm. reunion, you had talked about, like, I think I had said to you, well, I know you're probably making your whole living now from mm. your art, and this podcast is partly about finding the balance when maybe you aren't. But you had said at the time, you're like, well, that really didn't happen until, like, this year.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what kinds of stuff you were doing for day jobs before that, or how you have found, if you were asked to work without compensation before, how you kind of, like, juggled all those things.
Okay, well, I mean, when I'll tell the beginning
part. That
was
the most succinct question.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get what the question is. I understand. When I first got to New York, I was waiting tables because I had no money at all. Like, I remember moving to New York 10 years ago, and I had something like $250 in my bank account after mm-hmm. I paid for the apartment and and got all my stuff moved from Providence. So I went and got a serving job really quickly, and I did that until I booked my first job, and then afterwards I was like, I can't do that anymore. And I mostly felt like I couldn't do it because I didn't like the life. I didn't like staying up late. I didn't like all that stuff. So I trained myself. I studied for the SAT again. And I went to this SAT firm and I took the test for them to become an SAT tutor. And I...
That's the interview, is you have to take the SAT again?
Yeah, you have to go. The interview is come in, talk to the guy who owns the company, and then take the SAT.
Jeez.
So I studied for the SAT one weekend. Really the math stuff, I mean, you'd be surprised how the verbal stuff, especially if you're like in the theater, you've been reading.
It's the math that I haven't touched.
Yeah. The math was like, I needed a serious brush up, but it suddenly just like started flowing again. You know what I mean? I was like, oh yeah, that equation, like, you know, I remember what this all is. Uh-huh. And so I became an SAT tutor and that was great. And then after that, I sort of started branching off on my own and I became just did it freelance on the side. And that was really wonderful. Now, at the whole time I was doing that, I was doing these downtown off-Broadway shows, of course. And I remember one of them, like, I think I got paid... Mostly I was getting paid, like, $250 at first, and then, like, maybe around $500, and then, like, $1,000. And so you're working for 2 months... Right. On this project for that
for
amount of
stipend.
Money, and then trying to tutor in addition to that, like running around the city in your free time to make your actual money. Now that wasn't so bad. It was great. You know, I loved that aspect of my life. It was really nice whenever I didn't have to tutor anymore, but it required in the theater really starting to work on Broadway. Like the whole thing that's going on in the off-Broadway theater community right now about fair wage on stage, for designers and everything, it's a really serious thing because I really don't understand why you can spend millions of dollars on a production but pay your set designer $5,000.
Yeah.
And that's what happens off-Broadway. And the actors, you know, like, you can spend millions of dollars on a production but you pay your actors...
$550
a week.
Before taxes.
Right. Before agent and taxes.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem right. Like, I think there's a big problem in the off-Broadway theater community right now in terms of, like, how budgets are allocated. And the result is that you're not making a living wage off-Broadway. No one is. Maybe the people who are full-time staff at the theater are.
Right.
But none of the artists who are working there
are. Well, you can't save any money. Even if you are, like, you're paying all your bills, you're eating, but then there's nothing left over.
There's nothing left over. And I think it is a result of the fact that, you know, like, why are theater tickets so expensive? They're so expensive because it's really expensive to do theater. And there are so many people involved. And like we were saying earlier, that you can't make it alone. You have to collaborate with these other people. That's mm-hmm. what's so beautiful about it. In addition to that, you have to pay all those people. And that's a lot of money. Like, when I start even in my head thinking, oh, all these artists, like, if they were being paid a living wage, what would that mean? And when you start doing the math, it, like, adds up so quickly. So
No, and it's not easy. It's not as if these nonprofit theaters are hoarding their money.
No, they're just trying to scrape by as well.
It costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then I start thinking about things like the NEA, you know what I mean? And things that are funded through grants. And it gets like scary because I think definitely you and I would agree that art feels so important and the ability to tell stories in society feels so important and something that we should cherish and put energy and time towards. But the truth of the matter is, like, there's just not a lot of money in art. So there's a lot of money in certain, just certain places, but those are the only places. And so if you're doing a show on Broadway that has become a success, you are making a living wage, right? And you are making enough money to save. But in my experience in the theater, other than that, that's the only way I see right now how to have a life in the theater and really be able to like save money for retirement and all these different things.
That's so scary because it's such a small amount of
Exactly. And there are just a handful of people.
For actors, but then as a choreographer, for everybody, there's only one on a show.
Yeah, there are a handful of people who get to be doing it at any time. And 3 out of 4 shows on Broadway fail.
Yeah.
And when I say fail, I mean they don't turn a profit.
Right.
Right? And Broadway is the commercial sector of the New York theater community. So.
Do you have an agent who does all the contractual stuff and works all of that out?
Yeah.
I'm sure with Broadway it's different. If it does run for a long time, I'm sure.
All that stuff. Yeah. All that stuff gets worked out in advance. And I think, rightly so, it's like the more money the show makes, the more money everybody makes.
Yeah.
In a general way, you know?
Yeah. Have you done a lot of regional stuff as well, or have you kind of been sticking to New York?
I feel like I've been so lucky because most of my regional work has been regional work that was leading towards New York, right? Not necessarily Broadway, but like was coming to New York afterwards for some reason. And I have done regional work where that wasn't the case, and it feels like, I don't know, I just don't like being out of town, really. Like, I like being around my friends. Yeah. I like...
I think you're in New York.
Exactly. Like, I want my community around me. Like, I feel very at sea when I have to go out of town to work and I don't have my life around me.
What does your family make of you being an artist?
I think they love it.
Are they still in Indiana?
They're all still in Indiana. My brother, my sister, my nieces, my nephew, my parents, my grandma, most of my cousins, Catholic family, huge. So there are a lot of them.
Have they gotten to come see a lot of your shows?
They've seen quite a few. My parents are coming in a couple weeks to see Dear Evan Hansen. They haven't seen it yet. And my sister has, her children are getting older, so she's like being able to see more things actually. But they're very supportive. I think they love it. My mom tells this story about me being a little boy and me telling her out of nowhere that I was going to move to New York when I was older. And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because that's where things happen."
That's adorable.
Yeah, so I don't know where I got that idea, but I do feel like
I feel like I always talked about New York too, even though I had no idea what it was really like. And I don't know if it was from watching like the Today Show or when the Tony Awards, you know, I'd like tape the Tony Awards onto a VHS tape so I could watch the the numbers.
The performances, afterward. Yeah. Thank God for YouTube.
I remember watching, you know, like Cats on PBS.
Yeah.
Something about New York, but I really had no idea what it was actually like.
It's so strange.
Being from the Midwest.
Like, yeah, and then you get to New York and you go to Times Square and you're like, oh, this is what I thought New York was, but this isn't New York at all.
This isn't New York.
And this is actually horrible. Like, this
and
is the
this
worst.
Is mostly people visiting New York.
Right, and so all your visions of what it is get,
yeah.
You know, they change because you get experience.
Isn't that strange, though, that that's where a lot of your work is happening? The Broadway shows are right around Times Square.
Yeah, and if I sometimes am walking through there and I think, oh, I spent so many years of my life trying to get to this place, and now this is the last place in the world I want to be.
Right, like inside that building.
Yeah, fine. But please, teleport me inside the building and teleport me out of the building too, please. Yeah.
Do you have any, other artistic outlets or hobbies that you find as a when you're not working on a show or when you just need something that's private that you find as an outlet?
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't, when I'm not in rehearsal, I don't like thinking about the theater very much at all. And I feel like I really need diversity in how, like, information is coming towards me. Of course, you know, I love to travel, and travel is, like, very rejuvenating and, like, really presses the refresh button on how you view the world, yeah. I think. And I love that. I also just like reading classical works of fiction, like, which sounds so, like, whatever, but,
like a good Oliver Twist now and again.
Well, the last thing I read was, the Brothers Karamazov, and, like, I love reading things that feel huge in scope and ideological and, like, very, and they don't have to be classical either. Like, I like really getting engrossed in something, and feeling like I'm learning from a voice. And I like, my entire life I've gotten interested in a writer specifically and, like, read their things to try to understand their voice. And I'm really drawn to philosophical writers, and I'm, like, people who were with their literature really trying to say something about whatever their contemporary society was, or, you know, something grander about the human experience. And that, I don't know, I just really love that. I have this classic book club with my mom, and we, like, read literature together and then talk about it. And it's really wonderful, because I don't think that I would...
That's so fun.
Yeah, I don't think I would get through the things I get through either without her pushing me, and me pushing her, too. You know, so when you're held accountable by someone else that you have to, like, get through this, it really keeps you going in this way.
That's... What do your parents do?
They're both retired. They both retired this year, but my mom was a nurse and my dad was a machinist.
Oh.
So that means he, like, kept the machines, like, up and running in this bottling factory in Louisville, Kentucky. So when they broke down, he would fix them up.
My mind is trying too hard to create some metaphor about how those two professions combined are somehow related to yours.
Yeah,
nursing is all about humanity and the, you know, working the, you know, moving the bodies. Too far. I tried.
Well, you know, I interestingly, like, I do think when I look at my parents, I see how they combined to make me. Mm-hmm. Mostly because my dad is very mathematically intelligent, and being spatially intelligent too, like, in terms of how he can build a house, he can do all these things. And choreography is so much about math. It's about separating music into sections. It's about looking at things visually on the stage and seeing all the different parts and how it moves and how it moves inside of time.
Uh-huh.
And that always feels like a very mathematical process to me. And making shapes that have to do with how many dots you have in the grid that you have in front of you. And inside of that, making it live. You know, so my dad's incredible ability to do that mathematically in a totally different way than I do it, along with my mom's, like, love of words and storytelling, it makes a lot of sense to me how that led to, like, being able to do something like choreograph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't too far off.
No, you weren't.
I knew there was something there. I'm always amazed by people who can be nurses and doctors. To me, that's just so overwhelming and beautiful.
Yeah. It's like such a gift that you give other people to care for them, especially when they're at their weakest.
And just
weakest.
The amount of knowledge you need to have in your brain at any one time.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It is incredible. I know she started out, like, in the emergency room, and it was very, very hard on her. And then she worked at hospice for a long time, and that was... I think that was, like, very, very rewarding. She felt like she was really helping these people, but it was also very, very taxing to be around death that much.
Yeah. Is there, like, a lesson you've learned in the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about?
I feel like I'm learning... I do feel like I'm learning lessons all the time, definitely. Like, is there some sort of grand lesson? I feel like once I got in my 30s, I calmed down about so many things. Because I think you just get a little older and you're like, yeah, we're all people. We all have desires. We all want things. And we're all trying to move toward those things. And that's okay. And sometimes you're going to win. And sometimes you're going to lose. And like, sometimes you're going to be up. Sometimes you're going to be down. And just learning to weather those movements mm-hmm. better with like less psychological trauma feels...
This is the end.
Yeah, exactly. It feels
this
nice.
This low is the end. It's because never going to go away.
It's again. Never going to go away because you know it's not the end now, right? Because yeah, you remember being low a couple times and always coming up out of that. But also, I think the other side of that is that sometimes the highs... The danger is that I think you become a little bit more cynical about the highs because you're like you see them as, or at least I do, like see them sometimes as like just another part of the natural progression of it all. So you become like a little suspicious of them in a way.
Don't quite enjoy them in the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that talking about the dark side earlier, like that also, that cynicism is the dark side, right? Like instead of just being like, I can be in this happy moment and totally relish it.
Yeah. Well, that's the tricky thing. I always feel like you want to celebrate when you have a win or when you have some big success, but you also don't want to be judging the rest of your experience by that success. Like you can't always, because then when that's not happening, what are you devaluing your life?
Like, no, and you get like, of course you don't want to.
This year, my life didn't matter. No, but you also want to let yourself enjoy it. So there's mm-hmm. kind of that fine line.
Yeah, and continuing to define success as something different than praise or, you know, like money, you know, anything that it becomes very easy to define success by.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That Frankie and I are going to, we're going to try to make a push this year to be like just investing in our personal lives more.
Mm. Yeah.
And hopefully all the career things will happen along the way, but just to take that pressure off it and be like, if we can focus... Like, we are allowed to be important to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know? And we're allowed to celebrate ourselves and the people around us. And like,
and those things are,
and celebrate just them just for being themselves.
Some corporation
too.
Giving Frankie a job for 2 days, you know?
Yeah, exactly. More important in the end.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask, maybe you had mentioned the one teacher at Brown, but if you had any mentors who have been really important to you in your life, artistically or otherwise, but.
Yeah, I mean, I have a wonderful artistic mentor. His name is Jack O'Brien. He's definitely in his 70s, I think. Mm-hmm. He's a director. He directed a lot of things, The Coast of Utopia, you know, Hairspray, just a lot of different things. I met him one day because the public theater had called me and asked me if I was interested at all in choreographing Much Ado About Nothing in the park for them. And the reason they were calling specifically and asking if I was interested is because they had no money to pay a choreographer. They didn't realize until later that they needed a choreographer, and they were basically asking me if I would do them a favor.
Okay.
In order to meet Jack O'Brien. Okay. Basically, right? To be like, you would have the opportunity to work with Jack O'Brien, but you would actually be hired as, like, you know, not on a regular choreography contract, right? Which was weird, right?
Shady, but
this
sweet.
Exactly. So I show up to this meeting with Jack O'Brien, and we are like two peas in a pod immediately. Like, we are just like talking. We are like laughing. It is just so wonderful. And I feel so grateful to the public theater for putting me in the room with him. It was totally worth it, right? Like, it was very, very worth it. Yeah, to, like, basically not be paid but to
otherwise
do that show.
Otherwise, you would feel so gypped.
Yeah, exactly, right? So he's just an amazing person. And one of the things that I love about him is that somehow, throughout his entire life, with all the shit, he has maintained the innocence of his spirit so beautifully. He has maintained his naive curiosity about people and things and the world, and he infects the people around him with that. And that to me is like, just, it's so beautifully simple in terms of what I think a director can do in an artistic environment, which is provide a singularity of purpose, right? Like, really essentialize what the purpose is and then create an environment where everyone feels accepted, loved, like their contribution is valuable, but also feels pushed to create the best work possible. And I love that aspect about him. I love how he thinks about the whole event of making theater, but I mostly admire so deeply the way that he still feels curious about life. And when I met him, it was at a time where I was starting to feel a little beaten down by life. So seeing that in him really re-energized me. And then later we did this tour of The Sound of Music together. And I had always hated The Sound of Music. When he called and asked me to do it,
I thought,
yeah, like I fell asleep always after they got married, before the Nazis even came, because I was so bored by it. Right. And,
I mean, it was a two VHS.
I mean, it was long. It was long. And so he asked me to do this tour of The Sound of Music. And that was such an incredible experience because I went into it not being like, okay, I'm doing this show, like I have to find a way to enter in. And then because of his lead, being able to enter into it actually so easily and realizing what a beautiful, yes, old piece of theater it is. And how
But you got to see it through, he had these eyes for it.
Yeah, exactly. And that was wonderful, and working on it was really wonderful too. But I mean,
plus, like, have you really done many like revivals?
No, mostly new musicals. Works. Yeah, it's really plays. Kind of, I've done that. I'm doing Venus at the Signature Theater right now, which is a revival. And I did The Good Person of Szechuan. Oh, and I guess those Shakespeare shows too, but mostly I do.
But like classic musical wise.
Yeah, classic musical wise, really only The Sound of Music, which is so strange.
So interesting.
Yeah. It was interesting.
When was that? When did you guys do that?
We did it 2 years ago, I think. It was 2 years ago in August.
Yeah. Have you seen Indecent on Broadway yet?
No, I haven't. I want to, though.
You should really see it.
Yeah? Is it wonderful?
It has some amazing movement work in it.
Uh-huh.
I went to see it with my sister-in-law, who's a dancer, and I don't remember the choreographer's name, but she said that he's a big contemporary
dancer. I think it might actually...
Dancer.
Is it David Dorfman?
I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah.
But there's kind of this, cabaret aspect to it, in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds wonderful.
I always remember when you played the MC in cabaret at school.
Oh, yeah. That was so fun.
I'm actually interviewing Miranda later today, too.
Really? Yeah. Oh, cool. You know, interesting...
She likes, right over here.
Well, tell her about this, because Miranda and I actually choreographed a large part of that show. Did you know that?
I guess I did.
Because we had a choreographer. Vaguely. Her name was Randy. When I look back on it, I was choreographing for a really long time, actually, and I didn't, but I didn't see it that way, because...
I never did any of the musicals at Evansville, so I never, I don't think I ever met, like...
I think that was the only time I ever met
in that, like the...
her. But after a while, she was just like, Danny and Miranda, what do you want to do?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
What should the gorilla do at this point?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, I mean, you danced a little bit when you were a kid. You did movement through school. You danced at house parties at Evansville, as we have established.
I definitely did. I didn't start dancing in a class until I was a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
But before that, I was a gymnast and a diver. You know, very physical.
Do you feel like any urge now to like get training? And you're like, oh, gee, I wish I had a little bit of tap experience. I wish I had a little bit of...
I never...
Just as curiosity.
I never wish that I had...
Even though I know your choreography is something different, but...
I never wish I had dance experience, but I do wish I had different kinds of physical experience. And one of the things that I do is become kind of obsessed with a different kind of physical activity and train my body to do it. So when I got to New York, I was deeply into yoga. Then I got into rock climbing. I was very into rock climbing for a while. And now I'm really into tennis.
Oh.
And the different ways that you have to train your body to move and to experience what's going on to be able to do any of those things well is like endlessly interesting to me. And I also feel like it keeps your body like so nimble to be learning how to do new things in an intricate way. In a way that like just going to a dance class over and over again wouldn't actually, because then you're just like training the same thing over and over again, as opposed to like getting more experiences and more information.
Yeah. Do you have any do you have any projects in your mind that you're wanting to do kind of just on your own or like back to your Brown days? Like,
Yeah, I
creating
was
creating a piece with your friends.
Well, right now I'm actively engaged in trying to get this show that I've wanted to do for years going. So the novel Of Human Bondage by W. Somerset Maugham is about this protagonist, Philip Carey, who's born with a physical disability, like his left foot. They call it a club foot. I'm actually not 100% sure what you would call that affliction in 2017, but I don't think it would be a club foot. And that's what they say in the novel over and over again. And when I read it, and this was years ago, I started seeing this dance theater piece where the main character does have a physical affliction, and the piece is about otherness, and it's about being an outsider. And because this person has a disability, the whole storytelling, if it's dance theater, makes of that person the outsider and makes them not able to participate in it. And I started just like really ruminating on that idea. I became really interested in it. I talked to this composer, Michael John Lacusa, about it. He became really interested in it. We worked on it a tiny bit, and we sort of like made the... That novel also works like a... It's a Bildungsroman, which means that you... It's about all the things that go into creating a particular consciousness. So it's really all about this one person and all the things that happened into it in his life that led him basically to the end of the show, where he kind of makes a decision that he does have free will, that he's not in bondage to the universe or his emotions or his past or his physical affliction. And that because of that free will, he can make the decision that he wants to make, that he sees is best for him, whatever that is. But all the events that led to that moment of accepting free will, which is also like a very interesting idea to me. I was very into that idea about, you know, it feels great to think about free will.
It
really does. It feels so empowering, and it's true too, which is the really wonderful thing. And so we did a little bit of it, and then my choreography career just really took off, and I lost sight of it. And right now, I've been talking to Michael John again, and we're, like, very interested in trying to, like, figure out how to do it, coupled with, like, I feel very strongly that I need to figure out a way to start directing, mostly because I want the new challenge of something new to do, and I just feel ready to do something like that. So I'm trying to get this project specifically working in some way so that we could do it, you know?
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So when you are having like a day where you're feeling like you're not making the best choices or you're not feeling inspired, mm-hmm. when you're seeing the dark side in the distance, are there any like concrete things that you turn to again and again for inspiration or comfort, like a book or a... film or a place you go or something like that?
I think I just try to breathe. You know, like I really just try to like wipe the mind clear, because I feel like there is a place in my consciousness where I'm like, you're having a bad day, like you are, you know,
there's
like
no way out.
There's no way out. But also like, this is something that you are creating, you know what I mean? Like you are an active participant in this bad day, you know?
Yeah.
And then to try to just be like, just breathe, watch it go by. This is from getting into yoga, you know, and
yeah,
the things that I learned from that, and just like watch it go by, try to get back to neutral. And to do that by just like not latching on to those negative thoughts, and instead like just being like, that's a negative thought, there it goes, instead of holding on to it and then being dragged away by it.
Yeah.
Which is so easy to do. And I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying I succeed either. Like I, you know, but that's what I try to do.
Yeah. And then the last question I wanted to ask is if you've seen anything recently that you want to recommend.
Well, I don't see many things, to be honest with you.
I mean, you're working a lot during the time.
I'm trying to think the last...
It doesn't have to be a play, too.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
You already recommended a few books, which is great.
Well, I will recommend something to you that I'm making Yasmani Arboleda watch right now, which is called Avatar: The Last Airbender, and then leading into The Legend of Korra. Do you know of this?
I've heard of them, but I've never seen them.
So it's a Nickelodeon animated series, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. I think the storytelling is amazing in it. The world building is incredible. The character development is top notch. It's really, really, really wonderful. I love fantastical tales too. I've always loved people with like stories about people with powers.
Yeah.
You know, the hero tale. I love that.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but how is it for you guys to be like, how is it for you to be in a relationship with another artist?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
In this, I can imagine a version where it wasn't amazing, but what I find amazing about it is that he understands the artistic process. We don't do the same thing at all. What we do is very different. One of the things that I think is really interesting about it is that he's a generative artist. So he is coming up with everything himself. Mm-hmm. And I see myself as so much more of an interpretive artist, right? Like even the piece of theater that I want to make is based on of human bondage. It's not like a story that I started creating myself. Right. It's like taking stories that are out there, seeing a script that someone has already written and interpreting that and breathing life into it. And in some ways, I like wonder if the being a generative artist is more draining. Like I wonder what that feels like, but it's just not what I'm personally drawn, how I'm personally drawn to create. And I think it, no, well, now I'm talking about him in a way that I don't understand, but like, I wonder if it's lonely. I wonder if it's, you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if the pressure feels more because you're not sharing it right. with people. And well, that makes me empathize with him a lot.
Though, is about community and about
totally
interesting. So it,
yeah, so he's like breaking that barrier for sure.
You make your work in a community.
Yeah,
he makes his to affect a community or to involve a community.
To create a community.
To create a community.
Yeah, and that's really that's amazing. Similar. Yeah. Yeah. But I guess what I wonder is about the generative aspect of like just getting the idea to like pass out 10,000 balloons someplace.
Yeah.
And then being the person who, as you create that community, everyone is aware of that this was your
right.
thing. Right. But he really gives ownership to other people in this way that's really beautiful too. He really, really excels at people feeling ownership over the projects that they are doing with him.
Have you guys ever run into a time where you're both feeling kind of negative about your artistic pursuits?
Yeah, definitely. Like, and I mean, I think it
manifest in New York City in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, it's the dark side for everybody, right? And what's really great is whenever I'm in a low place and he's not in a low place, he can help drag me out.
Yeah.
And vice versa. What's not so great is when you're both
that's
in the low.
That's the tricky thing.
Yeah, that's the really, really tricky moment.
Frankie and
right?
I always say that's not allowed, but it yeah. sometimes happens.
Anyway. It sometimes happens anyway, and you've got to like, I don't know. I think you just have to be aware of it and just ride it out too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about Venus at all.
Oh, you want to talk about Venus? Let's talk about Venus.
We don't have to. But
yeah, let's do it.
I actually don't know the show, but I'm really excited to see it.
It's an amazing Susan Laurie Parks play from 1996. And it is about Sartke Bartman. It's a true story. 1810, 3 years after the abolition of the slave trade in England. Mm-hmm. This South African woman with a beautiful and big booty is convinced by an Englishman to come with him to London. He's going to make her a big star, dancing African princess. He's going to share the profits with her 50-50. The streets are paved with gold, he says. And she agrees to do this. She's going to come back rich, big bags of money. She gets to London. And I guess I won't ruin the story for you. It is a true story, so you could just look it up online. But nothing is what she expected.
Right.
And it's about society's fascination with the black female body and the racism inherent in that. And the things that happen with power. And it's a true story based in 1810. But interestingly, Susan Laurie Parks is a genius. Finds a way to make that story feel like a celebration of that woman and not just some sort of like dark societal commentary about like how evil society it is, how evil society is. She just like holds up that person, lets you see them, and she celebrates them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What kind of movement stuff is required in it?
So there's a chorus, like basically that functions like a Greek chorus. They play the chorus of the eight human wonders, the chorus of the eight anatomists, the chorus of the court, and the chorus of the spectators. And all of it has a very physical theater, dance theater, physical storytelling vibe to it. And she's also there to dance. So what's interesting is that the vast majority of my work in that has to do with the chorus and not her dancing, right. You know, which is kind of always how it is. It's never like what you expect to be the really complicated part.
Which space is it in there? Is it the, there's like the proscenium,
Griffin? The Griffin,
the proscenium. Jewel box. It's the proscenium.
It's okay. The proscenium.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And how long is it running? Do you know?
I think it runs to the beginning of June, early June sometime.
Okay.
We're just in previews right now. This is the second week of previews.
Gotta get in there.
Yeah.
Well, Danny, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So excited to have
you.
Yeah. Listening to the Compass podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.